Hi, I'm your host, Susan Ney. Welcome to the podcast series, HR Inside Out. It's a series designed to help you demystify HR and the human resource processes. We're going to talk about people management. You get the goods on and see how all this stuff works. You're going to hear from everyday heroes and get their perspectives as we touch on a wide variety of topics, topics that impact us in our work and in our work environments. You'll find nuggets for your treasure chest of learning. Hopefully, you'll discover insights for your personal and your professional growth. I'm glad you're here. I suspect it's because you want to be the very best version of yourself, your personal best, and that you get understanding these systems and processes will help you on your journey, on your path. You ready to dare to soar? Want to join me at flight school? Let's do this. Thanks for joining me today. Hi, welcome to the podcast HR Inside Out. I'm your host, Susan Ney, and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome our guest, Kate Bravery, to our time together today. Kate's one of the co-authors of the recently published book, Work Different, 10 Truths for Winning in the People Age. It is absolutely excellent, one I would highly recommend you consider reading, and one that we're going to be delving into today. Welcome, Kate.
Well, it's great to be here, Susan. I've really been excited about coming on your show, so thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. Now, first, a little bit about you for our listeners. Kate is a... I just want to share how wonderful you are, first of all. Kate's a corporate psychologist and a Mercer's Global Advisory Solutions and Insights leader. She's a senior partner with 25 years of experience advising executives on global talent trends and the future of work. She's a UK chartered occupational psychologist with an MSc in organizational psychology and an MBA. She has expertise in people strategy, talent management, assessment and leadership development, and HR process design. Kate commenced her career with American Express, where she focused on new employee orientation and its impact on culture and integration. Her interests in cross-cultural leadership and decision-making have been constants throughout her career. Her technical background lies in people strategy, design of talent management solutions, organizational development, performance and succession management systems, assessment and high potential development, as well as career architecture and job leveling. Wow. Kate is currently living and speaking to us from Brighton in the United Kingdom. Let's dive right in, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Susan, just listening to that list of things, I think that says just how old I am more than anything else. I have been around for a while and done this for a while. But
I don't know about that, but certainly wise. So, Kate, I'd like to actually start my questions in the back of the book, and where you summarize your data with what you term as the 10 truths for winning in what you term as the people age. Now, the first of these is goodbye employees, hello contributors. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, absolutely. It was interesting because when we were thinking of writing the book, we just come out of the pandemic, and I think everybody was recognizing that everyone has taken the moment, that pause, to reflect on their work. And one of my truths that I learned during this period was no one wants to work for you. Doesn't matter how good your pay and compensation, your benefits are, doesn't matter how inspiring your culture is, no one wants to work for you. They do want you to work with them. And that for me was the seed of this shift that we've seen from what we call an employee mindset to a contributor mindset. Let me just give you a flavor of some of the things we not only observed inside our company, but we started to see in our research. You know, the employee mindset is work-life balance. You and I know about it. You know, I'll shift my life to fit around the companies, and you know, I'm doing that juggling act. I want a long-term career. You know, I expect to be trained for my job, and then I'll be reskilled, and you know, I'll do my time, I'll climb my ladder, and you know, I will to a certain degree work within the lines, and also I want to know what is the company culture, and that will fit in with that, and that's what we grew up on. And yet what I'm now seeing, and I have the privilege of doing Mercer's Global Talent Trends study every year, what I'm now seeing is the new generation coming in just has a really different perspective. They don't want work-life balance. They want lifestyle integration. They are, you know, if you want me to bring my best self to work, it needs to fit around some of my life objectives. And they don't want that long-term career path. They want to know what's next now, and they want to be valued for the skills they bring today. They don't see their worth being defined by career levels and roles. There's a little bit of that, but they expect that their worth is defined by their contribution. They also want to contribute more than just profit. And that's a really big theme this year we see in the data. And they want to shake things up. You know, they want to play an active role in shaping the values of the company and impacting its culture. And I think that's really vibrant and exciting. But boy, are we underprepared to respond to that new way of working and that new set of expectations that are on managers.
And that's the contribution.
Yeah, that's the contributor. And you know what? We wrote this about a year ago now, and we've just released this year's Global Talent Trends Report, and it really reflects that shift, because we ask every year, and it's about 14,000 voices around the world, what helps you thrive? And this year, the number one is, what helps me thrive is a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging, feeling valued for my contribution, and being able to contribute beyond just that profit. So we have seen that shift. And these weren't the things at the top of the list when you and I at the peak of our career.
You know, it's interesting. They may not have been at the top of the list, but I think probably as important, we just weren't in a position to, or we didn't articulate that, or, you know, we were just not prepared to.
Susan, I agree with you. We just weren't so vocal on this. And the other thing I've been fascinated by, and I know this links into the chapter on stressed out, burnout, and quietly quitting, is, you know, the Gen Zs, how vocal they are on health and well-being and mental health. And I agree with you. I don't think that wasn't there before. It's just we didn't talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting because your second truth is stressed out, burnt out, and quietly quitting. And I certainly wasn't surprised to see the stressed out and burnt out pieces, particularly with the impact of the pandemic. But this quiet quitting intrigued me, and you shared in the book that Gallup estimates that half of U.S. employees are already close to quiet quitting. That's a really somber second truth. And I suspect just it's not just pertinent with the younger generations of workers. What have you found to be the major contributors of this quiet quitting? And for our listeners, quiet quitting is a worker putting in the job's minimum requirements and no more.
Well, you know what's interesting? I mean, you just mentioned there the whole stressed out, burnt out, and quietly quitting. And I can just tell you hot off the press that burnout rate has actually gone up this year globally. So we are not heading in the right direction. Before the pandemic, it was down near the low. 60% of people felt they might be at risk of burnout this year. Straight after the pandemic, because we had old ways of working and new ways of working, it shot up to 80s. And now in the US, it's 84%. That is staggering. And 40% of the workforce in the USA, 39% globally, 40% in the US, the work is fundamentally broken. So we've got some problems that we need to fix. And the book is not pessimistic. I think the book's very optimistic. But this one particularly, I think, is a really intriguing phenomenon, because it was coined when you had people speaking on TikTok and others about, if I'm not basically getting a fair deal, and the psychological contract with my boss or the company is broken, I'm going to do the bare minimum I need. And it's almost the flip side of that employee advocacy that we were just saying, and we were just saying has shot up and we're praising. But it's when it goes over too much to the point that you cannot embrace some of the exciting technological transformation that's happening, because you've got a workforce that's putting the brakes on, mm-hmm. that is really doing the bare minimum. And I think there's a few things that are feeding into it. One thing that's come up is having a really big impact on people's intent to stay, their engagement, their sense of thriving, not being at risk of burnout, is trust. How much they trust their manager, how much they trust the organization to do the right thing by society, and more recently, how much they trust senior leadership to make good business decisions. Now, this is a very different relationship that employees are having with their work. And one of the things we asked in our recent study is, what erodes trust? Because we have seen that trust has dropped quite a bit this year. And when it drops, you get a number of things. You get people taking more time off, but you also get this quiet quitting phenomenon. And what they said was, number one, broken promises. So we're flip-flopped on things like flexible working. Number two, frequent org changes. You know, you and I know there's going to be more of them happening this year. And unfair treatment. And the unfair treatment is interesting because we also said to people, why do you stay with your company this year? We give them a list of 20 items. And what has shot up into the top position? Fair pay. Not absolute pay, fair pay. And it's not a surprise. We've got pay transparency laws coming in across the US. We've got pay equity laws. We've now got new sustainability reporting in the EU. You can actually just reach into your pocket, grab out your whatever your ChatGPT is and say, how much do I pay for this? We are living in a world where people's worth is very clear. Mm-hmm. We've had more people go on strike in the last few years than we have seen in decades. People are feeling the pinch of the cost of living. They're evaluated whether they're getting a fair deal. And when they don't feel they're getting a fair deal, they're putting the brakes on. And I think that lower engagement and that preparedness just to not put in that time or go what we would say above and beyond is a real risk. Because when people are in the right role that fits their motivation and they're inspired, you get all of that great thing. And I'm not saying we all have to be workaholics and work crazy hours, but we're not clock watching because we're actually thinking, oh my gosh, how much of this great work can I get done before I'm clocking off? As opposed to, oh, how much do I need to churn for until I can kind of close my laptop? That's a different mindset. Yeah. And we need more of that in our organizations. And, you know, when we look at trust, we know that, you know, trust goes both ways. We have to trust people and we have to be trustworthy. Flexible working was a good experiment around that. But, you know, and trust is reciprocal. If you give trust, you gain trust. If we want our organizations to be dynamic and responsive, we have to defer more power to our workers, which requires trust. But they also need some guardrails as to what does that look like, particularly this generation that didn't get socialized in the same way you and I got socialized. And that, I think, has led to some issues. And we do know that if we want to build that trust and reduce the incidences of quiet quitting, you know, we need to show competence as business leaders. We need to show benevolence, doing the right thing by our people. And we need to show integrity, which is being a lot more honest and transparent. And that includes about some of the equity gaps that maybe we haven't made as much progress on in the past.
A lot for organizations to be contending with, and understandably really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a lot to contend with. I think the most important thing this year is setting a few clear goals, being vocal about them, and staying the course on them. Because you're right, we're living in a much more complex world and there's a lot of issues to tackle.
Wow. Yes. And I've thought of many, many things as you've been talking, and we could make this podcast 3 hours. So I'm hopefully going to touch them in some of the other truths.
I get passionate about the book.
Well, and one of them was passion, because I know when I've worked with a team that I know I've called a team that just hummed. And it was just such a pleasure to work with the individuals. We loved the work we were doing and it made such a difference. So,
absolutely. You know, if the team is quiet quitting or if they're inspired, because you can feel it, you can smell it, you can see it. And it's so invigorating and it transcends culture, gender, generations. And we need to get that right, particularly when, you know, we're ushering a new age of human machine teaming, which is exciting and scary at the same time.
We're going to get into some of that new technology a little bit later in the podcast. The third truth is that it doesn't pay to stay. And you do talk about a number of positives for the individual, such as the gaining of new experiences through those kinds of moves. But man, that's tough on organizations. The whole recruitment retention challenge. The colleagues left behind, the impact on them. Your thoughts? It's one of the truths of this people age.
Well, for Mercer, which is basically the largest conversation firm in the world, it was an unusual, I think, chapter for us to to kind of get out there. But the reason why we ended up having this chapter was because myself and my co-authors were actually in an airport, and we overheard somebody who I think worked in HR basically on the end of the phone talking about this issue. And they were saying, I know we can't hold on to our people. I know that they're leaving. You know, they were saying there's nothing we can do. Yes, you know, we've got a good brand and good training when they come in, but we don't give them, you know, long-term benefits. We don't share our equity. You know, there isn't much of an incentive for them to stay past 2 years. And then the piece de resistance, they started to say, actually, I worry more about the people who stay rather than the people who go, because the people who stay are the ones that don't have the confidence to go elsewhere. And obviously myself and my colleagues, because we work in HR, you know, we started listening into this thinking, gosh, when do we get this so wrong that a people leader or an HR leader is resigned to the fact that that compensation planning is kind of tying their hands? And so we did a bit of research to have a look at, well, actually, does it pay to stay? If I was a switcher rather than a stayer, do I end up earning more or less? And so on first blush, you are absolutely right. And I think in 2023, those that left got 16.4% average pay change. And that was a lot higher than what it was at the 3.8 that you got for people who stayed. So on first blush, particularly in certain markets like the US, you can earn more by job hopping. And is that really what we want to respond? Do we really not value loyalty? We did another piece of research that showed if you have a more tenured member of the team who's been with the organization 15, 20, 25 years, they actually have a positive impact on people staying, not just with the people around them. They have a positive impact on the Gen Zs and the Gen Ys as well. So there really is something to this. And of course, it is cheeky because actually, we believe that when you stay, you build social capital. When you stay, a lot of the psychological safety, can be built up. And where we end up saying it doesn't pay to stay in your current role for too long. And our call is for greater urgency in building more vibrant talent marketplaces, moving people around quicker. And dare I say, moving people out of fixed jobs into either flex or flow roles. What I mean by that is a proportion of their time can be spent on learning or internal gigs or fully flow roles, because the reality is we're actually running out of people. We don't have enough talent to meet our future needs. And that's without even putting on the demographic time bomb that is happening. And so we have to value our human resources a lot more than we have in the past. And we need to build more agile talent models so they can contribute in more ways quicker. And you know what the interesting thing is? They stay longer when you do that.
Oh, absolutely.
Because one of the big reasons they're leaving is because they go, I don't want to wait a whole year until I can be considered for a promotion. I don't want this retrospective performance management engine dictating my future. I'd rather get out and do something else. We also see that many of the young people want to have gigs on the side. And there's some really progressive companies in the book that are figuring out how to do that and how to reward loyalty. But yeah, it's one of those truths that many people in HR know that hasn't figured out yet how to fix. And AI is actually playing a role in helping us kind of personalize packages and fix some of that so that we don't get inequity between people who come in and people who've stayed, as well as between the genders.
I think it's really important for organizations to become more creative in figuring out those growth opportunities. And I am going to be asking about AI a little bit further on, so why don't we hold that piece for a little bit later. The fourth truth, it talks about that purpose rules and empathy wins. And you've talked a little bit about it already, about how critical it is for articulation of a purpose that people can believe in, and the importance of alignment of decisions with that purpose. Oh, how true. that purpose and cultural alignment have never been more important. Are you seeing that that's finally being recognized in the work that you do with the organizations you work with?
You know what? I actually believe we are seeing a big shift on this than we have in the past. We saw a bigger shift last year when the labor market was a little bit different. I think when the labor market, when people don't trust the labor market and that they'll get another job, then I think it swings a bit more to the employer. But I think we are seeing really good strides on that one. We are seeing employees asking their companies to come off mute on what they stand for. Mm. We have seen that this year, executives have said, the one area we have to make progress on is around our ESG and sustainability reporting. Mm-hmm. And that was global. And that really surprised me because it does have a political undertone.
Yes.
And I also have heard anecdotally in the report that many managers say, I have to be able to answer questions about what are we doing in the markets we operate? How much does the diversity of our workforce represent them? What is the gender balance in senior leadership? I get questions around our board diversity. I get questions on what we're doing around net zero. I don't know about you. I didn't ask that of a prospective employer, but that is the reality we're in. So I think the younger generation being as vocal as we started off this conversation saying they are, mm-hmm. is beginning to say there's nowhere to hide. Now, you've had investors over the last few years really putting a focus on kind of the environmental side of ESG. They've really switched attention now to the S. And so they're looking for more sustainable people models. They're looking at progress on DEI. They're looking at human capital disclosures around equity and fair pay and all these topics we've just been talking about. That's put that on the corporate agenda. And I think that's quite exciting. The other thing is young people want to be part of that. And so more and more, they're asking for a proportion of their work to be in some of these social responsibility areas. And that also, I think, is giving some momentum to organizations on this agenda. We've still got a long way to go. Don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. but I do think how an organization translates its values into things like inclusive benefits is a conversation that just wasn't happening 5 years ago. You know, what do we mean? What are we doing for same-sex marriages? What are we doing for women's reproductive health? What are we doing with regard to living wage around the world? Do we care about these topics? And if so, what does that mean for the total reward package we offer? Mm-hmm. And I think that's exciting.
And also an opportunity for some of those creative opportunities within organizations to involve employees in some of those reach outs, some of the community engagement, involvement. So very, very positives. And as you say, the book has got a lot of positives and lots of really great ideas. You talk a lot about empathy in the book and the importance of it. And that's about walking, understanding what it means to walk in someone else's shoes. It seems that you found this to be a really critical piece. And I think we're going to move into some examples and some of the other truths, but talk a little bit more about empathy and how important that's been.
Look, I think we all learned about empathy during the pandemic. We started to see the person behind the machine, the job, the Zoom tile. Mm-hmm. And that was really positive. I also think executives learned to be humble and transparent, even when they didn't have the answer. All good things. Mm-hmm. Now, as we face economic headwinds and tailwinds, and we need to tighten our belts, we need to make sure that we balance that empathy with economics. And I think the two do go together. You know, you just mentioned there about, you know, we were talking about ESG and DEI. You know, we've got to make sure that we're not just a fair weather organization and we invest in those things when we've got abundance and mm-hmm. we pull back on them when we don't. That's a real risk for your talent attraction and retention. You know, therefore balancing economics and empathy for me is saying, every time we talk about our corporate goals, it's not just our profit and our revenue goals we talk about. We talk about what are our goals with regard to society, to the environment, to employees, to customers. and making firm commitments on them in exactly the same way we would on our financial areas. We did some work a number of years ago, which is in the book, with the World Economic Forum on what constitutes good work and urging companies to set bold goals. You know, by 2030, we will upskill X employees to keep them employable. By 2035, we will ensure flexible working for all. By 2025, we will ensure living wage by all. These are some of the commitments that I think help organizations deliver on that promise of stakeholder capitalism, hold them accountable for making sure, and I know we're going to touch on AI in a minute, that as we bring in new opportunities with AI, they actually benefit the humans in our organization and benefit society. And I think keeping an eye on that is more important now than it's ever been. So I do think balancing economic and empathy means some tough work about building in those other goals into your P&Ls and galvanizing the organization to make progress on them in the same way that we have in the past on the purely corporate or shareholder agenda.
Just for our listeners, the Good Work Framework, as outlined by the World Economic Forum, lists five elements of what they term good work. It's probably a good place to insert this. These being, and they're wonderful, a healthy, equitable, resilient, and human-centric future of work, respecting fundamental rights across in-person, hybrid, and virtual work for all workers. That's a pretty wonderful thing to aspire to.
It is. And I know that there's about 30 companies that have signed up with goals on that. And there's some really innovative ones in the health and well-being space where people have said, you know, year on year, we want to reduce stress-related illnesses by 1 or 2%. And when we've got non-communicable diseases rising, we've got the stress incidences that we were talking about earlier, and we've got young generations impacted by physical and mental health. Setting some of those bold goals, I think, demonstrates that you care. Back to what builds trust, mm-hmm. what ensures that you don't get quiet quitting. It's all the things we've just been chatting about.
And it's the alignment too, you know, of setting a purpose and making decisions that are actually consistent.
Yes, it's going to make sure that that EVP promise is actually the lived experience. Yeah. And that, I think, is really important. And that it's congruent between your customer brand experience and your internal brand experience. And there's some good examples in the book of, I think, who's getting that right and where there might be some misses. Because, you know, we live in a transparent social media world. You know, people sniff that out pretty quick.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's something that people talk about around the water cooler and the pubs. The transparency is certainly broader with what the reality is. The next truth is trust and accountability. We've talked about that. The importance of that delivering psychological safety, the climate of learning innovation. I think we've probably touched on that sufficiently. So I'm going to move to the sixth truth, which talks about the new rhythm of work. And there were a couple of points under this truth that I want to delve into. And again, we've touched on it, but I want to go deeper, that if we want to inspire the next generation in our workplaces, we need to redesign workplaces around their diverse needs and interests, tackling head on what demotivates and disengagement and disengages them. And you talk about the need to flex loudly. I love that term. And I think you've talked about flex. What's flex loudly? And this individual interests being critical importance. And again, there's that empathy piece that comes into it because it's about recognizing what those are for the individual. What's flex loudly and an example of an organization where that's done effectively?
You know, I think, gosh, we've all been obsessed with flexible working and return to office ever since the pandemic period. You know, first that wonderful digital experiment where before the pandemic, very few leaders thought we could ever work remotely. And then their eyes were opened and then none of us wanted to come back. You know, I know I'm only talking about a segment of society here, but boy, we've been on a journey on this. And you're right, flexible working does relate to some of the other topics we've talked about, such as trust and just getting enough agility into our workplaces. In the book, we talk about when we consider flexible working, let's move away from just talking about where you work, because it's not about being on-site, off-site, or hybrid. Particularly as we want to get flexible working happening for non-knowledge workers and frontline workers who were pretty fed up during the pandemic, they didn't have that option. Mm-hmm. We in the book introduced the six dimensions of flexible working that we at Mercer evaluate each job's potential on. And AI is a big part of that. How, if we look at how tasks could be allocated to AI, you could actually reduce certain dependencies and allow for more flexible working. But the Flex Loudly is, whatever your company policy is, if there are times when you are flexing out of work because, you know, you like to take Friday mornings off to play golf and, you know, you've worked that into your schedule and that's fine, talk about it, you know, share with people that you're doing that. If you are working for shortened week where you've taken a 20% pay cut or a 10% pay cut and you're doing a 9-day fortnight, don't hide that. I think what's been happening is we've got lots of exceptions, and there are exceptions for very good reasons, but no one is talking about it. And then you have a situation of the haves and have nots, and people don't really understand why. What this period has forced us to do is to set some really good rules and expectations about when you need to be in the office, when you need to be out of the office, which jobs should flex, which jobs shouldn't flex, how we can think about the how work is being done and who does the work and shifts and schedules. You know, a lot of the things that went out of fashion, like job sharing, really can support people with children at home. The opportunity to go down to a 3-day work week really supports people who want a phased retirement. There are lots of benefits of thinking really creatively as opposed to the more sledgehammer approach. And Susan, what's interesting this year, in our Global Talent Trends study, we asked how many companies last year made changes to flexible working and how many will make changes this year. Spoiler alert, about half are still making changes, so we haven't landed, but 32% went towards more flexible working and 10% encouraged on-site. And we asked the 32 why, and they said, because it's driving up productivity and it's increasing employee engagement. Back to that quiet quitting. The ones that said they're encouraging more on-site said it's because our people aren't learning the corporate behaviors they need. Our managers have difficulty managing remote and hybrid teams. We've had an increase of mental health issues, and we're worried about cyber risk. And I think that just shows that we haven't got it right. And we need to invest more in managers in having a constant conversation around flex working, because what I wanted 6 months ago is different to what I want now. And it's going to probably be different in 6 months' time. The companies that are getting it right are recognizing it's not a once and done. It's nuanced to the job and how you show up in the job. And it might be influenced by people's life stages and the lifestyle contract that they want.
Yes. Yes, yes, and yes. Those critical conversations. And I love that the new generations in particular are insisting that we actually have those. Mm-hmm.
They're asking us before we're asking them, which I think is good because we're not playing catch up, but boy, it can be overwhelming.
Yeah, it can. And, you know, I certainly feel for people who are overseeing people, because if you're not provided those skills of having those kinds of conversations, of recognizing that those conversations are really important, which certainly wasn't in any of the accredited education that I received. And I suspect that it it probably, I know it's gotten better. So those are also positives. Just continuing to think about the whole individualization, you speak about what you term as a principal agent being an important stakeholder, because of course there's many stakeholders in all of the stuff that we're talking about. Now, as I read the section, the union came to mind. And my involvement with unionization is that it's all about the collective. It's not about individual interests. Have you found in your work that unions are starting to become more like recognizing more that some of the old historic rote step seniority, not paying attention to individual, it's all about the collective, is starting to change to this people age new reality?
I think you're absolutely right, Susan. We do need to evolve how we interact with work councils and unions around the world. And they need to evolve how they work with us, because we've got a talent crisis coming. We've really struggled to meet employees' expectations around the world on pay, given the cost of living crisis. We've got people going to strikes because of AI coming in and infringing the copyrights on their work, or disrupting their work livelihood because of the opportunity to do more platform business. So we are rife with conversations. And one of the things I benefited from on writing this book is having people from different parts of the world. So Ilya Bonick, who's the president of Career Mercer, is based in the US. And Kai Anderson, who leads on transformation in Europe, is based in Germany. And it was just wonderful comparing Germany and the US. And it's interesting because in Germany, we see that, you know, that pay disparity between new hires and legacy, minuscule because of the work councils. You know, in the US, do we have investors in the US saying this hiring and then riffs and then hiring and then riffs is actually not the most respectful way to manage talent, and actually is a signal that maybe you don't have a sustainable people model? You don't see that in other parts of the world where it's more difficult to let people go. Now, there's the flip of that. You've also got some of those in more aging economies where we've got to bring more vibrance and we've got to be able to make changes more quickly because employees, the individualistic piece you were talking about, is demanding it. And so I think both parties are recognizing that if we're going to bring the agility into our talent models, we need a different way of working together. Because, you know, this year, although executives around the world are bullish on growth, I think, gosh, they're predicting, you know, 10 to 15% top line. One in two says we don't have enough agility in our talent models to deliver on that growth. And that is related to some of this rigidity, which has come from these long, protracted discussions on all aspects of work and work negotiation.
Thank you. We're moving to AI. Truth 7 talks about skills being the real currency of work. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by skills? And let's move into AI. What's the impact? You talked in the book about when your skills become devalued by AI, that they also will take a hit in adjacent fields. So over to you. Let's get into this very important development.
Yeah, well, you're now on my favorite topic. So I am as fascinated as everybody else is on AI coming into our workplaces and what will be the impact on the workforce, the future skills that is needed in that workforce, and actually how we will work together with more human machine teaming. And although I think we all agree that AI is not going to take away whole jobs. In fact, there's a really nice quote. I'm going to forget the gentleman's name. There's a really nice quote by Stephen Baldwin. He said, AI won't take your job, but someone who knows AI better with you probably will. And so I think you're right. It is about the skill. And even though AI augments at the task level, our research shows that up to 80% of roles will be touched by AI. And what we saw in our research is executives are expecting some real productivity lifts by bringing AI into the firm. The majority of them think it's going to be at least 30%, which is staggering. And employees are worried about, well, what does that mean for me? Are you going to expect me to work harder? Because quite frankly, I'm already feeling depleted, distracted, exhausted. Mm-hmm. And so I think we do need to kind of bridge that knowledge gap so that employees know, how are you bringing AI into the firm? What would be the likely impact on my future job? And to your point, what are the skills that I need to stay relevant and to stay employable over the longer term? And I think some companies do a really good job in having that conversation with their employees, and they're much more transparent about AI and future skills. And others, there's just a void. And of course, when there's that void, people get uncertain about their job prospects. And you and I know, when people get concerned about their future job prospects, they play it safe. And then we don't get the innovation and the boldness and the curiosity that we actually need to usher in where we could be in the future of work. So there is a lot really going on the AI front that will impact jobs and livelihoods. And I think the most important thing for everybody in the call is to be in that conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're in HR, listen to the HR practitioners that are experimenting with AI and hear how they're doing it. Be curious about it. Play with ChatGPT if you're not using it, at least on a weekly basis. And for employees, challenge yourself. You know, what are the new skills coming into my industry? And where do I sit compared to those skills? And if the future job I hope to have disappears, what are two different skills? One of the things that I really like that the Singapore government does really well. Now, Singapore, smaller country, so I understand it. They have a skills council that on LinkedIn publish what skills are going to become more in demand, so play a real premium because they're very specialist. Mm-hmm. And what skills actually allow people to do multiple jobs. And I love that because they also give a learning account for everybody to spend on training as they like. It's direct to employee, direct to individuals, not through the company. But that allows individuals to say, do I want to learn really highly specialized skills and go for gold? Or do I want to learn skills that allow me to do lots of different jobs? But I love the power that it gives to individuals in that market to control their future. And I don't feel we have that everywhere around the world.
No. And I think there's a lot of people that really struggle with sort of knowing or knowing where to go for that kind of information, and that our organizations could be doing a much better job in providing that kind of guidance.
Yeah. I think the imperative is now. This whole movement away from jobs to skills-powered organizations is picking up pace. This year, the amount of companies that invested in talent insight tools, talent marketplace score tools, scraping your background to make judgment on what skills you have or you don't have, is a train that is running. And I think individuals need to take control over that narrative as much as they can, you know, leaning in, making sure the right content is on LinkedIn, using ChatGPT to say, what skills should I have in my job? What are the best people in my job have? You know, what are two or three potential jobs if you have these skills? You know, getting equipped yourself, because I agree with you, some companies are lagging on communicating where the future is headed and what skills will be needed.
Those critical conversations again.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that we all have to be lifelong learners. It is. Mm-hmm. It's not about getting a degree and, you know, that's it. I've got my education. I don't need to do anything more. It's just, that's not our world anymore. Hey, I want to take us to some of this, the talent GPT for HR technology, given that this is about HR Inside Out. You talk about it redesigns the experience of talent acquisition and talent management for both users and for HR. Can you talk a little bit about the impact this is having and how it works?
Yes, I think one of the exciting things that's come into the HR world, I think pretty early, has been how AI is being used to understand what skills are available in the talent marketplace and understand what skills the people in our workforce have today. And that's allowing much better matching at a skills level to the tasks.
Okay.
Now, you know, that can enable you to hire the right talent with a lot more confidence than we could in the future. But the bit that I've got really excited about is how that thinking is being implied, is being turned in-house. And it's being used to say, you know, if you have these skills, if you gather these two or three other skills, you'd actually have more opportunity to go into jobs in the future. And hey, here are a couple of internal gigs that can get you that experience. Because you mentioned there about training. We don't have time for training anymore. I think we've got to make sure that we are creating space for learning the skills of the next job in the jobs of today. And I think talent marketplaces, internal gigs, special projects, whether you do them using tech or not using tech, is a fantastic way that we can build the skills that we need in the jobs that people are doing today. And again, it's what young people are craving as well. So I think AI being used to that's really exciting. The other piece that I'm seeing AI being used within that context is actually matching people who can be skills mentors because they're really strong at a particular skill or they've learned a particular technical skill with people who've identified that's a skill I need. And so I think that human matching where you can match people up has really worked. I think being able to also then link that to your LMS system and have a much more connected up conversation between, I've got a special project over here and I need to fill it. This person needs to have, you know, these technical skills, these behavioral skills, and would love them to work in one function of our business and one particular location. Give me all the people who've got that. Give me all the people who might be a retention risk. Give me all the people who would benefit most from developing them. Overlay them together and then tell me how we get the best return for who we give that job to. Not just return for the organization, but return for the individual in terms of investing in their future. And that's what some of the generative AI overlay is allowing us to do. And isn't that wonderful? Because you and I spend a lot of time on spreadsheets looking at lots of different systems. And we wouldn't even want to ask an analyst to do that work because it's a heavy lift. But that's what we want to do. We want to make sure that every opportunity isn't just filled today, but is a learning opportunity for someone for tomorrow.
It really is exciting. I mean, you reference spreadsheets. I've worked in organizations where those kinds of things weren't even gathered. And so there would be no opportunity of seeing that, you know, person X might be a great mentor or person Y, you know, has those skills, perhaps not being used in their current position, but absolutely could be placed in something else that would give them a growth opportunity.
Yeah. And you're at the mercy of your boss. If your boss was in a role where he was well-networked and very visible, you might get great opportunities. If you weren't so lucky, your field of vision was also constrained. And I think what's exciting about this new technology is it doesn't just democratize opportunity, but it also increases visibility of your skills, motivations, and capabilities. And I think that's exciting.
Oh, God, absolutely. Hey, Truth 8 is supply is unchained. How's that specifically related to what you call the people age? Just really quickly.
Well, actually, you know, one of the truths I think that we learned through the pandemic was work can be done in ways that was never originally conceived to be done. And it can be done across cultural, temporal, geographic boundaries. And as you start to explore that, you realize, wow, actually, we can think about our site selection in new ways, not being close to the customer, because that's maybe not our critical gap, but being close to where those skills are, or those skills are at the right cost. And so that's really, you know, added a new dimension to sort of labor arbitrage, and a new dimension to how we can think about fueling our business with those really hard to get skills, by maybe looking at untapped populations that have sort of skill adjacencies. And that's what we mean, that supply is no longer chained to a job. It's no longer chained to a location. Heck, it doesn't even need to be chained to an organization. And so we talk a lot here about the opportunities of thinking about your talent supply chain, thinking about more network organizational structures with suppliers and customers. And so, yeah, we want to encourage companies to embrace that and to think about managing supply chain with the same level of diversity that they would their business supply chains, to make sure that you don't get exposed by not developing the skills that you need for tomorrow.
Well, it's about being creative. I mean, we're dealing with a skill shortage, and that's not getting any easier.
Yes, necessity really is a mother of invention, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And that pressure is just going to increase as, you know, we still grapple with labor participation rates. As we grapple with demographics.
Yes.
Yeah, and that will only get more acute as we look at demographics, and especially if we aren't doing a good job of keeping some of our more tenured knowledge workers, as some of our research shows we're not at the moment.
Thank you. Truth 9, intelligence is getting amplified, and it's about having smarts, knowing where to go to, how to acquire what we need. We talked a little bit about that, and how that has the opportunity to be an intelligence equalizer.
Well, we talk a lot there about the use of large language models. Obviously, writing a book, when we wrote the book, we were halfway through the book, Gen AI burst into the scene, and we thought, oh, is it a thing? I think it is. And then obviously we had to rewrite the book. And in fact, we actually put the whole 10 truths into a large language model and asked the machine, if you'd read this book, how would you manage differently as a result? And for me, that was the first time I'd had a machine give me advice about how to manage my team that was probably better than what I was intending to do on Monday. So that was a bit of an eye-opener for me. And if you buy the book, you can actually see that exchange, because we just put it in directly. But yeah, it's always a bit worrying when you write about AI a year before the book releases. But what we talk about there is, from those early lessons, what is the opportunity to bring human capabilities and machine capabilities together? Because when you've got human intelligence and machine intelligence together, you get amplified intelligence. And I think we always knew that was coming back from, you know, Garry Kasparov. I don't know if you remember him when he was beaten by Big Blue in chess. I think it was back in the 80s.
Yeah.
he was knocked down by that, but he came back. And, you know, he said, actually, the brightest chess grandmaster can't beat the computer, and the brightest computer the brightest chess master will struggle against the computer and the greatest the computer that. But what he also found was an average human with an average computer can beat them both. And it was the combination that gave the lift. And that actually ushered in a whole new form of chess, which, you know, is now commonplace. But what he was talking about there is to unlock that human potential in a machine augmented world, you've got to understand the process. You've got to understand how to work with the machine. And that's what we're doing with prompt engineering. As we are beginning to learn how to converse with machines, and that's going to get on steroids when we get conversational AI, it's going to change the way we work. It will change jobs. It will change what we learn. It will change what we don't learn. And, you know, getting ahead of that and experimenting that, I think, is one of the most important imperatives for HR today. It's not a digital thing. It's an HR thing, because it's about how humans will work and the lift that we'll get by working with machines.
I love the example you gave of even within the school system, of teachers having to, you know, how do you tell whether or not this essay was written by the student, and techniques that are needing to be put into place. So similarly, how do we work positively with this? It's not going to go away.
No, absolutely. I have two young children. I have a 9 and an 11-year-old. And it's been fascinating because, you know, during the pandemic and just after the pandemic, there was all fear about, gosh, you've got to submit 3 times, once with ChatGPT, once without, and then once combined. All of that is dissipated now, I think, because there is a recognition. It's just a tool. It's a multi-purpose tool. And my kids have actually got pretty savvy at saying, yeah, that's rubbish, Mom. Obviously, sometimes they say that to me, but they're also saying it, God, to ChatGPT. And I'm glad they're learning the lessons now, because it is just going to be the way we work. But what I worry about is they're not doing, this goes back to that very first trend, they're not doing the hard graft that you and I did. And the reason why I can look at an engagement survey or a personality profile or a comp sheet and go, ah, something's off here, is because I looked at lots of them as an analyst. And so that ability to thin slice and bring that wealth of experience to go, that, something's wrong there, they won't have that because they're not going to do that type of analytical work. Now, would that bore the pants off them? Yes. But that's something we've got to consider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Last truth number 10, and I think it nicely ties everything together, is this: sustainability starts with people. And you stress that knowing what different people want from the work experience is paramount. We've talked a lot about that, especially if we don't want to find ourselves out of people. We've talked about that. It's a big shift in my experience of working within organizations and how they continue to function, and really is going to call for some pretty big system changes. You talked in your book about the need for deeper partnerships, underpinned by mutual respect, humility, transparency. I think we talked about a lot of that. And you've seen that start to happen in the examples that you provide in your book. Any comments on Truth 10 about sustainability and what this is all about?
I agree with your comments, Susan. I do think it is a reset. But gosh, if there's ever been a time to make that reset, it's now. We've just been talking about the opportunities afforded by generative AI. Most executives think it's going to give a 30% productivity gain, and we have a choice. Do we take that productivity gain and say, let's share it with all stakeholders and maybe put investment for upskilling, put investment for health and well-being initiatives, or return them some time in a 4-day work week? Or do we flow it to the bottom line and return it directly to shareholders? And if we fundamentally believe that the purpose of an organization isn't just to deliver profit, but to keep our people employable, to do good in the world, to make a difference to the environment, all the things that I think we should be focused on and our young people want to see us focused on, I think there's pause, because this productivity gain with AI gives us some space. It gives us some breathing room to maybe make this reset. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't make that reset and really think about what's the purpose of our organization, what do we want to do for all our stakeholders, we will just keep on the treadmill that we're on. And as we shared, work is not working for everyone. You know, 1 in 4 people don't want to work at all, and 40% believe that work is fundamentally broken. Because we have to work, we get away with a lot. But this, there is an opportunity to build more inspiring, more intuitive work environments. And it's a virtuous circle, because those are the ones that the best talent are going to flock to. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that the best talent are going to stay with and move forward. And yet in the book, we have some companies that's made that bold moves. I talk about the Patagonia book, Let My People Go Surfing, where they took a look to say, we are no longer delivering on our values. And they did a fundamental reset. And then they basically taught ethics to their workforce to make sure they could execute on it. We also talk in the book about Unilever, who listened to the fact that many of their people wanted side gigs or they were more tenured and wanted to have more time off, but they love being part of the organization. And they figured out how to give job security, compensation, benefits, some level of security, and flexible working. I mean, they're the two R's of people. And so we're entering a world where there doesn't need to be these trade-offs, but it does take some bold actions to reset. And honestly, I think HR is in the best position to lead the charge.
Thank you. One of the challenges, and you spoke about it right at the end of the book, is organizations' resistance to change.
Oh, and, that's a big...
I think you've just given us two excellent examples of organizations that have managed to make that change stick successfully. As we bring the podcast to a close, any other thoughts on that point? Is that change in organizations is always a struggle?
Yeah. You know, although I do think people have more of a relationship with their organization and they want to work for a brand that they're proud of, and that's really come through in the voice today, I also think people are inspired by people. And it does take a bold leader to be convicted that there is a different way to do things. Work could feel different. Work could look different. We could all be working different to pull the charge forward. I think if we keep tinkering around the outside with our reward, our talent, our health and benefits, we don't make the world of HR particularly inspiring. And we miss this opportunity to inspire the workforce to be part of a big workforce revolution. And that to me is just such a lost opportunity. Yes, I think pushing our transformation agendas and our change agendas when people are feeling fatigued and exhausted and distracted is tough. But when you get it right, everything falls into place. And we've seen enough green shoots of companies being bold and challenging the way it's done to give us confidence that the world of work that we experience today shouldn't look like that for my kids.
Love it. And when you talk about bold leader, we're not talking the CEOs or the C-suite executives. We're talking you as leaders overseeing people and taking the steps that are available to you, being creative, being curious, engaging, having those conversations. That's really what leadership is about. And bold leadership incorporates much of what we've talked about. Kate, any last thoughts? Anything I've not thought to talk to you about or ask you about before we close?
No, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today. One, because I know you read the book Inside Out.
I did.
So I was a bit worried about coming on. But two, no, I think we've touched on so many points today. And, you know, I hope we have managed to inspire people on the call that there are some bold leaders, and I agree with you. You know, it can be people right, you know, in their first or second job that are challenging how we work, and they are figuring out ways to make work more exhilarating. And I want to be part of that journey because I think it's really exciting.
Oh, me too. It is exciting. And that's why I loved your book. Oh my God. It's easy to read. It's well researched. It just makes so much sense. And love the work that you're doing with Mercer's, the future of work. Wow. That's cool.
Well, I benefit from a lot of great talent in Mercer and two wonderful co-authors to the book as well. So that's why it's so rich.
And I've worked with Mercer's within Canada, and you're with a wonderful organization. So
thank you.
Kate, thank you so much for making the time to be with us here today. Kate shared with me, this has been a long day for her with a number of these kinds of opportunities of making a positive difference. So very much appreciate that you said yes to this one.
It's been great. Thank you.
I've put your contact information in the show notes to the podcast if people would like to get in touch with you, and certainly we'll put a link to the book if anyone is interested in purchasing a copy. And again, as Kate alluded to, I've took lots of notes. There's so many ahas. Thank you, Kate.
And I agree with you. We could have spent another 2 hours talking about that. I'm impressed that you managed to get it in the time that we did. And Susan, I look forward to the conversations offline with yourself and anybody else who wants to reach out on LinkedIn. You know, myself and my co-authors feel incredibly passionate about some of the things that we say in the book. They are bold, but hopefully we'll spark a conversation. But thank you all for listening. And thank you for inviting me on, Susan.
Thank you. It is time for us to go. To our listeners, thank you for listening in. And remember, dare to soar, because we believe you can. It's Susan and Kate signing out. Have a great rest of the day, everyone. Kate, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Bye-bye. It's been lovely.
Well, we've reached our destination for today. Time to lower those wheels and prepare for landing. Thank you for joining me. If I said something that resonated with you, please subscribe to the podcast and to share it with others. It would be awesome if you also took the time to provide a review, whatever your favorite social media sites are. If you have a question or an area that you hope I'll cover in a future session, please send me a note, either to my website, www.effectingchangefromwithin.com, or to my email, susangnay@gmail.com. I look forward to our next time together. In the meantime, soar high. I believe you can. Susan signing off. Thanks again for joining me.